felt by the higher command that this could be the decisive battle in Italy, that if the breakthrough could be made, that to the Lombardy plains, that the road to Vienna was pretty well clear. And this was the sort of prospect that was placed before the Allied troops. And there was to be quite a massive assault by the 8th Army along a fairly narrow sector on the Adriatic side, a sector which was some 30 miles deep and perhaps not more than 15 or 20 miles wide. The width varied as you progressed up the boot of Italy. The line, the Gothic line as it was called initially, and then I think the Germans changed the name after we cracked it, but the Gothic line stretched all the way across, and this was something that they were determined to hold, but they had relatively few people in position to hold it. Now, on the disposition of troops, the Canadians were given the right coastal sector, which was the sector, of course, that would be the most logical for the breakthrough and for the exploitation. But unfortunately, they were not given the extra formations at the beginning which would allow them to do this. There seemed to have been problems between the 8th Army commander, General Lees, and the Canadian Corps commander, General Burns. And the British were very reluctant to make additional formations available to the Canadians. And consequently, they beefed up the 5th British Corps, which was operating on our left in a hilly and then mountainous territory, embracing also San Marino, the 5th British Corps, I think, at one stage had 7 or 8 divisions under command in an area which really allowed very little progress and hardly any room for exploitation. But anyway, we were all briefed as to the plan of action, and I was given command of C Company. I can't remember the circumstances surrounding this, but I had command of C Company, and on the initial assault, and I have to consult my notes about this. Yeah, the initial assault was on the 25th, 26th of August. And this was an assault by the Polish, Canadian, and the British 5th Corps, with the 8th Army crossing the Matero River. At that stage, there was hardly any opposition. And we know from later evidence, in fact, although the fortifications were there, they weren't manned. On the 28th of August, we had reached, and our regiment was engaged in this, the higher ground south of the Foggia River, and just beyond that lay the main defense of the Gothic line, which had not been completed, but were still pretty formidable. Not of the caliber of the Hitler line, but still certainly not any pushover. The problem, I think, as far as I can gather, is that the whole plan of attack and the objectives of the attack were revealed to Germans by a very great misfortune, in that the Germans captured a document which contained General Lise's message to the troops, sort of saying, we are now going to deal the enemy the final blow, and we are going to proceed, you know, so forth and so forth and so forth. And this, of course, indicated the intent of the operation. So the Germans immediately rushed reinforcements to the Gothic line and also to the Rimini line behind it. The 5th Armored Division went into action, and it pretty well broke by 1st of September the outer defenses of the Gothic line. And then on the same day, the Edmonton Regiment went into action again. And this was my sort of first major action during this particular campaign. And that was with respect to a feature called Monte Duro. There were two very high features called Monte Duro and Monte Pelosa, and they were really the guardians of the Gothic line, controlled the approach and onward movement. And the 5th Armored Division had captured Monte Pelosa, and the Edmonton Regiment was given the task of taking Monte Duro with British tank support. So there were two companies, as far as I can recall, that were assigned the assault role, C Company, and I think again it was B Company. And there was a fire plan that was laid on. We rode the tanks partway to the objective, which was in broad daylight. We disembarked, started the assault on foot. There was some heavy shelling, and I mean heavy shelling from heavy guns. And it was the first time I'd ever seen artillery shells coming at us. And some people seem to think that it was gunfire from the naval batteries that were back on the coast. They were coming over the brow, over the top of this dam, Monte Duro, and then sort of coming down. And they looked as big as rain barrels, terrifying and intriguing sight as these things came whomping past. Well, of course, the idea was to get behind our barrage as quick as we followed up close to it. And I guess at that stage we were probably the advance elements of the 8th Army. And I had a lieutenant, Keith McGregor, who was an excellent officer, very, very quick and decisive, and took advantage of whatever opportunities. And he decided to rush the summit. But unfortunately, he forgot about our own timed artillery barrage. So Keith rushed the summit, and down came our own vast bit of our barrage. But anyway, they jumped into some slit trenches at the top, in amongst the Germans who were there, and took refuge and took the Germans prisoner. And that's how Monte Duro was was captured. And so brought the company up, and we consolidated. And shortly after, the commanding officer at that stage was Colonel Bell Irving, who, as you know, later became Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia, and is a very good personal friend and also a very good friend of the regiment, was commanding, came up, and he had given me my sort of areas that I was controlling, and I'd spread out because to cover the whole ridge. And he said, no, you consolidate over here, and I'll send other companies up. And I said, well, I can see the ocean. What about giving me permission just to keep right on going? I don't see any opposition. Well, no, that couldn't be given because the tanks couldn't support us and so forth and so on. But as far as I can see, just on the surface of it, as a company commander, the way seemed to be clear. From later captured documents, I don't think it was a company job to do it. But if we had been able, if they'd had a new division to have put through at that time, there was hardly any German defenses left, Dave. But it was only after that General Leese then assigned a British division and a New Zealand Armored Division to Canadian control. In other words, he bolstered the Canadian Corps. So, following that, the main battles were on the Coriano Ridge, which was mainly 5th Division, 5th Armored Division, that distinguished themselves. And the Edmonton Regiment didn't come into the picture again in any sort of big way until the what we call San Martino and San Fortunato ridges. And San Fortunato is the last ridge before the Lombardy Plains, just to the west of Rimini. And San Martino is a village just to the south of it. Now, after Montalero, I thought that we might have had a bit of a rest, because again, we've been very fortunate in taking that without any casualties. San Martino was a key element to be taken before the assault on San Fortunato. And it was being very stubbornly held by the Germans, who had moved in. Again, elements of the paratroop division. These are the people that we had fought all the way up from almost from Sicily right up through Italy. And they kept reappearing in slightly different form, different faces, but with the same fighting abilities and same, again, determination. The San Martino had been attacked by the Royal 22nd, who claimed to have captured it. The position was then turned over to the Sea Force, and at the end of the whatever happened, the Germans were still in control of San Martino. And there was recriminations both ways that the Royal 22nd never captured it, the Sea Force let it go. But anyway, it was not in our hands. And apparently, for the attack on San Fortunato, which was the, as I mentioned, the last ridge and the key element before the final breakthrough to the Lombardy Plains, the instructions, or the battle orders, to our battalion was that the start line was to be San Martino, with the comment, however, that this may still be in enemy hands, and that consequently it might be necessary to regain it, or to repossess it, or to possess it. So I was called in along with the commander of A Company, Gibby Blair. And we were told that we were to attack San Martino at first light, that it was to be a surprise attack, that we were to have support, British tank support, at a troop level. That would be three or four tanks. That there would not be any intensive artillery preparation. That the sea force had been repulsed in a further attack upon it. And that it was pretty essential that we gain this. And I remember, as I left the old group, as we called it, that the commanding officer jokingly said, "This time, Johnny, I'm going to bleed you." And anyway, we didn't have time for any reconnaissance, and we made the approach under cover of darkness. We passed through the Seaforth positions, and just as first light broke, we reached the forward slopes leading to San Martino. And there were a number of abandoned trenches and that type of thing there. And we were just proceeding through those when we came under tremendously heavy and concentrated artillery and small arms fire. Both from the village of San Martino and also, it seemed, from San Fortunato, which was to the rear. The result was that we weren't able to get into San Martino. We found that it had later that it had been reinforced by the paratroopers. The battle went on, I would expect, for 3 or 4 hours. And finally, the orders were given, or it was agreed, that we would withdraw. The word retreat was never used, but the idea was to advance to the rear. The other company commander had been killed. His company had suffered severe casualties. That would take a lot of time for the company to recover from. I had suffered 17 or 18 casualties, out of a company strength at that stage of perhaps 65 or 70, so it was quite, in proportion, quite heavy. And when we were to withdraw, in fact, the platoon under Keith McGregor wasn't able to, he was in such an exposed position that he asked for permission to stay. He had some sort of a dugout that gave him some protection. It was much safer to stay there than to try and get out, so I agreed to that. And we conducted a rather undignified withdrawal back beyond the hill, and I had some difficulty in reforming, and I'm speaking very frankly now, the same sort of lines of the talk I give for the staff college, had some difficulty in stopping this withdrawal before it went much further than had been planned, and in fact, consolidated, because there were two companies involved, and one without a commander. But anyway, eventually I was able to get them stopped, at which stage the second in command of the battalion came up, Jim Stone, Major Stone, who proceeded to give me a real dressing down for this disorganized withdrawal. And I remember saying that I thought that this was unfair, and I think that the fact we were both very lucky that, in fact, the withdrawal had been able to be stopped where it was and not quite a bit further back. Anyway, as was typical of Jim Stone, for whom I have absolutely the highest admiration, he said, "What happened to you?" I said, "Nothing." He said, "Well, why are you bleeding?" And, I said, "Damned if I know." So there was a nasty cut up here from something, a bullet or something. So the next thing was that the doctor came up with Major Stone and to treat this. And sort of said, "Well, maybe we should take you out to the RAP." And I said, "God darn it, no. I'm mad. I'm staying here." So bandaged it up and we got things sorted out. I was placed in command of the sort of two companies at that stage, just to consolidate back there. The battalion, in the meantime, had been ordered to press on with the attack on the left across the valley and up to the beginning of the slope of San Fortunato, and they had, in fact, reached the beginning of the slope. So, although the attack in San Martino, which had drawn very heavy German fire, and was not successful, it did serve, I think, as a diversion and allowed the other people to move under cover of this attack to the left. The interesting thing is that one of the officers on the study of the Gothic Line is a German, Gerhard Moom, who was a company commander of the Germans, who had his position about 50 yards on the left. And we came under fire from his sector also, and he remarked that, in fact, the Germans had been ordered to defend San Martino to the bitter end, because this was a key point. But once it was outflanked by the successful move to the left, they did abandon it that night, and patrols from the 48 Hunters came in the next morning and found it empty. So the battle had moved on to San Fortunato, and I thought that again that we would be, we were a reserve company then, and A Company in fact was almost non-existent. But I was then called in. The attack went in against San Fortunato. It was a kind of massive attack with artillery support, an attack with the use of searchlights for the first time. To guide, to give direction, and to provide some illumination. And as in this type of attack, communications appeared to be lost between the and said told that there was no contact with the two advancing companies, which were B and D companies, and that I was to go in. And my first objective was a crossroad over the crest, and that I was then to push on to the church, which was the far feature of the church of San Fortunato del Lorenzo at the end. San Lorenzo and Monte. C Company girdled its loins again, and we moved up into position. And it was one of those sort of deadly hushes that battlefields sometimes take, and I always find that a very ominous type of thing. And I, quite frankly, didn't know quite what to do. And I wasn't quite too sure where we were. And so I took my batman, and we went out in a little sort of recce, and found a sunken road. And we could hear sort of the caves on the side of the sunken road. And kind of hear murmurings and mutterings. He sounded Italian to me. It certainly didn't sound German, so I thought, well, again, do the unexpected. We'll go right up. This will go very silently and single file and well spaced. And if it's successful, we'll all be heroes. If it's not, we'll all be dead. So away we went. And we went through without a shot being fired there. And got followed a little, the Sumter Road up, and then we veered off to the left. They now, incidentally, I shouldn't mention this, but they now call this Dugan's Trail in the Italian sort of history of this thing. I didn't know this until they had great ceremonies in Italy when I was there. And we veered off to the left and went down a valley, and because my idea then was to come up, not to follow the spine down. We've been so lucky so far. I would veer around the left, come up sort of behind this crossroad, because we could hear tanks and we could hear infantry. So we did that, and as we were coming up to the crossroads, we could hear sounds of firing. We hear a tank, and then just as we were getting near the road, a lot of Germans came marching up the road. So we attacked them, and dispensed with them, took prisoners, what, those who were still in this world. And then we found that, in fact, B Company had gotten through, not quite to the crossroads, but just above the crossroads. That the other company was there with company headquarters, and that was all. They didn't know where the rest of their company was. And I reported this. I was able to get through with my company set to the CO, and he said, well, proceed on to San Lorenzo and Monte. So it's getting pretty daylight by this time, and then suddenly we started getting fired upon by tanks or self-propelled guns from the top of the ridge behind us. And anyway, I sent a patrol down this road, which I've, you know, gone back to the last couple of years, to the church. And there were a lot of Germans around, but there was no organized resistance. So this patrol came back, running back, said it seemed to be possible to get there. So we, as far as I can remember, we did double going down. I always advise people now, you know, about movements. Walk when you can and save your strength when you have to run when you have to. But at that time, I think that we reckon we were pretty lucky, so we went down as fast as we could, and we got into the church, and it was a beautiful location. Absolutely 360-degree view. We could overlook all the German positions. We had the Valley of the Po right in front of us. And the Germans were completely disorganized. So we were able to, we didn't have an artillery officer, but we had a system where I could get back to battalion, to the Fua battalion, and we laid the thing back. And we brought back artillery chutes on tank concentrations, artillery concentrations, sorry, on withdrawing infantry. We had a real productive day. A lot of prisoners, a lot of vehicles knocked out, a lot of artillery pieces. And that evening, bless his heart, a jeep arrived towing a trailer, it was a Ben Gunn carrier with a trailer, and a Ben Gunn carrier with a anti-tank gun. And that gave us some protection against counterattack, and also it had brought up the rum ration. It also contained Jim Stone, the 2IC, who got a well-merited decoration for this. And that was a big boost to morale, I can tell you, because we felt kind of lonely out there. There were five German Tiger tanks sitting just down below us, and I was only hoping they wouldn't know where we were. I don't think they did, but they were dispersed eventually by the artillery. So that move up to the river, and this is the famous Rubicon, you know, the one that Caesar or Hannibal, whatever it is, it's got some significance. But the rains had come, and we spent the night on the river, and the next day the New Zealand division was supposed to go through, and I think they went crashing through about 300 yards and bogged down, and that was the end of the offensive through the Gothic line. Well, it was then a holding action for a short while. I finally got my promotion to major and was given command of A company. Sort of the hard luck company. They had lost two company commanders in the Gothic line. And there was the next phase, I think, of the operation for us in Italy, where what might be called the battles of the canals, because whereas we'd had to cope with the spines coming out from the main mountain ridges in our advances before, and now the ridges had disappeared, but what we had were the canals and there were rivers that were diked that were coming down from the main central range, and they formed just as formidable an obstacle. And I ended up in the war in Italy, commanding A Company up on the Signo River, which was the furthest that we'd advanced in Italy. And I can't really recount many. I can recount stories about that, humorous stories, which I won't. Don't think I really want to record them, but. In March 1945, as you know, the Italian Corps was transported from Italy from Leghorn across to Marseille, and then we went up through France, regrouped in Belgium. Four of us had leave back in England, four officers, Colonel Stone and Al Johnson, Army Armstrong, and myself. We luxuriated in the Savoy Hotel for, I think, a week or 10 days. I don't think they really wanted us back again, but we certainly enjoyed ourselves. And then back, when we got back, the battalions were in Holland, and our first action in Holland was to cross the IJssel River. I think it was the IJssel River, yeah, the IJssel, near a place called Gorssel, which was to the north of Arnhem. And my company is one of the assault companies going across. I might say that the Edmonton Regiment was regarded as being an assault regiment. In the same token, the First Division had the reputation of being an assault division, and I think that we probably had the, other people may not agree with this or even say it, but the people, the staff colleagues say that we had the reputation of being the finest assault division in the Canadian Army. I'm only repeating what they say. I'm not saying this.
I heard that said by someone in the Saskia line too.
On our own behalf. But anyway, we always seem to have the assault role. So we assaulted across the IJssel River, and we had a few casualties, but took all our objectives, advanced into, we were going, now I get my directions wrong, you see. We were going west. You see, we had to liberate the western part of Holland. We were going west and advanced rapidly, eventually, as the war was about to end, we were holding the line near a place called Amersfoort, and this was the sector of the line where the truce negotiations for Northwest Europe were taking place, and also the sector where the food convoys were to be sent through. So we had a sort of a semi-official ceasefire. As you know, we had a sort of a truce day before VE Day. But when VE Day came, we were out of the line because we'd been chosen as a battalion to represent Western Canada in the victory parade in Berlin. And we were concentrated at a place called Nelspiet. And we were to turn this assault battalion into a parade battalion. And it was quite a change. But it was something that these people responded to as they did every other challenge that they had. And we then moved from there to Almelo, where I met my future wife. And I remember we would mount a guard, and particularly this one night there was a guard from my company. And I was very proud of this because I said, you watch now, and if you can see movement, I'll give you so much. And this battle-hardened old soldier stood there, never flickered an eyelash, never moved. I was so proud of him. Anyway, eventually it was found that they didn't send a complete brigade, they sent a composite battalion. And this company that had taken these terrible beatings in the latter stage of the campaign in Italy, A Company, was chosen as one of the companies to go to Berlin. And we got as far, I got as far as Hanover with them, and unfortunately I developed some awful things called desert sores that I picked up in North Africa when I was wounded. And these things came back, and I was in pretty dire straits. And the choice was either between trying to get back to the battalion or being evacuated to a British hospital, which would mean that I'd probably never get back to my battalion. So I got permission to get an inner tube and sit on it and take my driver a jeep and go back to the battalion. And this friend that I mentioned so often came up as my successor. And so Al Johnson took A Company to Berlin. And on the 27th of August, in Almelo, my wife and I were married. And it was quite a wedding. I think the whole battalion came. And we had a very, very short honeymoon in Amsterdam, where we were joined by most of the officers. In fact, I think Al Johnson actually stayed in the honeymoon suite. So, just a little story. About the third day, I thought I better go back and check in my company. And I went back, and I found that all the NCOs had been placed on charge. Because they'd gone to the wedding, and they were AWL. The battalion was not in Almelo at that time. It was based in another spot. So I went to the brigade acting commander, who was a regimental officer who I'd known extremely well, and I said, these bloody fools have put my NCO on charge, I said, for being, not getting back in time for my wedding. He, in fact, sang at the wedding and so forth. He said, that's bloody nonsense. So he phoned up the acting CO. He said, what's this bloody nonsense about putting Dugan's NCOs on charge? Well, when they weren't back, when he said, that's bullshit. They all put you up on charge. So they all came off of charge, and I was able to go back to my bride. And then a couple of days later, we left, the battalion left, Holland, and we went to England, and then we were repatriated back to Edmonton. But it was the Loyal Edmonton was a fine battalion. It had a tremendous reputation, and as you know, it's now in the reorganization, 4th Battalion PPCLI. And when the Canadian Guards were formed, it also contributed several companies to it. It had many distinguished people that served with it. General Kitching commanded it at one time. Brigadier Bell Irving, who, as I mentioned before, became the governor, a fine officer. And I think perhaps one of Canada's most distinguished soldiers, most courageous, and certainly one who saw perhaps more action than any other commanding officer, Colonel Jim Stone, who was a legend in his time, and still, you know, is a legend in his time.
When did you leave the Army?
I left the Army in November 1945.
No desire to stay in?
No, I was offered to stay in, and then when I came back from Oxford, I was, again, an offer was made to come back in, retain my rank and seniority, and I sort of said, well, I made my choice, and I had my eyes set on foreign affairs, and I have no regrets, although I find that some of my old Army friends are still my old and best friends. But this, you know, I mentioned Al Johnson, whom you'll probably be interviewing, or maybe not. He's not here during the summer. He's coming back on Sunday, but he's only here for about 10 days. He, you know, we joined the same day. We were commissioned the same day. We went overseas in the same ship. We both became captains. We said, if one becomes a major, the other becomes his 2IC. I have to become the major first. I asked where he became my 2IC. I made life miserable for him. He became a major at my wedding. He was the best man. We came back on the same ship. We were demobbed on the same day. It's that's quite a coincidence. It doesn't happen that often. So I have very, very happy recollections of our regiment. We have a good association here. We have a dinner in February, which is stag only, and then we have a picnic on the first Sunday in August, which is everyone. And this year we expect over 150, we're going to, he doesn't know this, but we're going to particularly honor Jim Stone, because it'll be his 70th, coincide with his 79th birthday, so we've arranged a little program for the Master of Ceremony. A good feeling in the association.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, or any topic that we haven't discussed?
I don't think so. Can you think of anything?
No, we covered most of
it. I've probably spoken much too long and too slowly, and I speak slowly only because I'm trying to remember things as I go along.
Yeah.
It's a long time, you know. It's 45 years. For some of this stuff.